This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the New Books Network in British Studies. I'm Tyler Yank, a co-host of the channel, and today I have the pleasure of talking to Dr. Lisa Zay Winters, Associate Professor in African American Studies and English at Wayne State University. We're here to discuss her new book, The Mulatto Concubine, Terror, Intimacy, Freedom, and Desire in the Black Transatlantic, which was published in 2016 by the University of Georgia Press. Lisa, welcome to the show.
Hi, Tyler. Thank you. Thank you so much for inviting me to be on the show. I'm really excited about this.
Wonderful. I wonder, Lisa, if you could begin by saying a little bit about yourself.
Sure. Yeah. So as you said, I'm an associate professor in English and African American Studies at Wayne State. And actually, all of my degrees, my BA, MA, and PhD, are in African American Studies, and for the PhD with a specialization in African Diaspora Studies at University of California, Berkeley. So I come from a very interdisciplinary background, and I was lucky enough to have a real kind of community of mentors and professors and classmates that are like, you know, very much family, but also an intellectual family to me in terms of how I think about my work. So that, I think, is that.
Wonderful. I guess the first question I have is to do with the cover of your book. And I wanted to draw everyone's attention to the image that you have on the front of the book. Hopefully our readers can see the cover page just above the link to this interview. So it depicts a woman seated, dressed very elegantly. Could you tell us a little bit about this image, why you chose it, and what it showcases?
Yeah, I mean, this image is from an 1853 atlas that accompanies kind of an encyclopedia by a man named David Boila, who was a Senegalese priest, and his mother was actually a seigneur. And so this image depicts a seigneur who are like a celebrated class of women, part of a class called habitants, or the inhabitants of St. Louis and Gorée Islands in Senegal. And these were women that were famous for their relationships, their kind of marriages in the mode of the country to European men. And they really kind of forged business ties and developed, you know, a wealth base in these two Atlantic ports. And the reason that I wanted the image really was to kind of work in juxtaposition or even kind of contestation with the title of my work, because I use the mulatto concubine in that phrase very deliberately and a little bit, slightly polemically, but really to kind of understand all of the tension that's inherent in there. But one of the questions and one of the things that I really wanted to work through in the book is kind of how and when we frame women of African descent who engage in sexual relationships and extra legal marriages with white European men. How and when do we name them mulatta, and the ways in which naming them mulatta doesn't always align with kind of their visual appearance. And so one of the questions for me is kind of what's at stake there. I also really appreciate, you know, this image in terms of kind of this juxtaposition between the senior who is dressed in very distinctive garb that is very specific to the senior. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a melange of European and Wolof dress practices, but she's seated inside the, you know, interior that looks like it could be someplace in France as opposed to in a village on the island of Gorée or San Luis. So I'm really interested in kind of that tension and what and the work that that image does, both in Boileau's Atlas, which is kind of in contemporary kind of understandings of diaspora and Blackness and gender, because this is also an image that you can pretty much kind of, it just circulates everywhere on the web. So that's where it's coming with that image.
So can I ask, so this concept then of the mulatta concubine, how did you come to write about it? Was there a set of documents you found in grad school, or was it something that have been, you know, this concept has been percolating through your work on diaspora studies? How did you come to it?
Yeah, the way I came to it, I feel like it was just the happiest accident and one of the like real pleasures of doing you know, research, right? Because I actually came to graduate school thinking that I was going to work on 20th century African, Caribbean, and African-American literature. And I was initially, I mean, I came to graduate school interested in representations of mixed-race women, and I was going to kind of build off of my senior honors thesis where I looked at Michelle Cliffs Ubbing and Ella Larson's Quicksand and Bessie Head's A Question of Power, and I was really trying to think through like the ways in which the figure of mixed-race women is always kind of attached to you know, madness and this kind of you know, a kind of embracing and resisting of this notion of the tragic mulatta as like a literary figure. And so that's where I was, I came, you know, to grad school thinking I wanted to really think through the very specific historical context for you know, across diaspora for this figure that seems to travel. And at once it's like seems really consistent, but at the same time is really different. And precisely because of the distinct historical context. Yeah. But I was kind of struggling with it. And I was sitting in my advisor's office, Veve Clark, and I was just talking through, and she was just like the most amazing mentor and advisor because she had that really wonderful gift of being able to kind of tell what you were thinking and like recast it to you in ways that were really coherent, right? Yeah. And made sense. And so I was sitting there just kind of talking, and she just like jumped up and she grabs this, there's these little, you're probably familiar with them, hatchet guides, which are these like little blue tour books. Yeah. That were really popular, I think, in the 70s. And she grabs one for Senegal. And I mean, Veve was like a polyglot. She was she conceived, you know, she comes up with the term Marasa consciousness, and also elaborates the Syrian diaspora literacy. And she just lived it. So she was so she had gone to Senegal as a graduate student to in part to study Wolof. And so she grabs this book, and in this book, there's like this short passage, and the book is in mm-hmm. French. And there's this short passage. She just opens it, and there's this short passage that describes the seigneurs, and it describes them as mulattresses, which was, that was kind of the moment that I was like, oh, this is odd, because it was from 1970. So it's outside of an 18th century context. Like the text of the guidebook, right? So the guidebook wasn't quoting an 18th century passage. This was like a 1970 description of a historical group of women. And so it describes specifically as mulattress as opposed to like métisse, for mm-hmm. example. And it was just one of those moments for me where I was just like, I really kind of confronted my my bias, I think, in terms of thinking about diaspora and my very U.S.-centric ideas about thinking about diaspora, because I had never even kind of thought about mixed-race women in a pre-colonial African context. Like, I had never even thought about that. And so to see that term, and it's such a specific term and with, like, all kinds of, like, vexed weight and around, you know, ideas about sexuality and race and gender, and to see it in that guidebook, I was just like, oh, I need to find out more. Like, what is this? And so that is what started my kind of journey from thinking I was going to work and specialize in 20th century, you know, contemporary literature, to just kind of, I kept going backwards and backwards because I just wanted to find where this was coming from. Where did these women come from? And the other thing that struck me, like, as I started reading about the seniors, and again, like, you know, research is so, it depends so much on serendipity sometimes. And I actually had a book from undergrad. I have no idea how I came into possession of this book, but other than I was just interested in African history, like, very, you know, as vaguely as an undergrad can be interested in African history. But it was women, and I think it was, like, I forget the title of the book, but it was an anthology or an edited collection on women in Africa. And there was an essay on the seniors in that. So I'd had this book in my hands the whole time. And I was really struck, like, reading about this, as I was reading about the seniors and started seeing, you know, these descriptions, I was like, oh my gosh, the descriptions of the seniors really remind me, really in visceral ways, of, like, descriptions of Ezuli, the Haitian Lua. And so that's when I started really kind of thinking about, okay, wait a second. I remember having that moment in Veve's office. I was like, oh my gosh, is Ezuli the seniors? And that's not where I ended, but that's where I began. I was like, okay, what's going on here in terms of this really repetition depiction of the figure, the mulatta, that I thought was very kind of U.S.-centric, and it is, and really, you know, and especially in terms of kind of 19th century literature, but in terms of kind of like this repetitious image of the mulatta across celebrated Atlantic ports, because that was the other thing that struck me. So I look at Gorée and Saint Louis, and then I'm colonial Saint-Domingue and Haiti in terms of Ezuli, and then my other site is New Orleans. So I'm also kind of struck by the celebrity status of the figure. So that's how I came to this project.
Yeah, that's a great story. And then kind of bringing it back to how you just completed your how you completed this idea and came to work on these three sites. Could you say a little bit about that archival process? So how did you piece together these three locations of Senegal, New Orleans, and Haiti?
Oh, wow. That's a really good question.
It's okay if you don't have a complete answer for exactly how, but...
I mean, I'm definitely of the, like, let me follow breadcrumbs type of researcher, as opposed to I know what I'm looking for, and I'm going to go find it. And I think that's in part because even though this book is not, I mean, I only have like one real literary text that I look at, you know, even though my training is in African American studies, I've focused primarily on literature and literary analysis, and always within a historical context. But so I never, like, as an undergrad, I never went to an archive, for example. And so that wasn't part of my, you know, coming in to graduate school thinking I'm doing 20th century literature. I'm not thinking like, oh, I need to go into an archive per se. And so part of it was just kind of trying to find out what was in the archive. So, you know, reading secondary works that were, you know, that would repeatedly cite certain documents or certain unpublished manuscripts, and wanting to go to find if there were other kind of gems or treasures in the archive, right? Like in those same documents. And so that was part of it. And again, you know, this is where I just feel like it's never a solitary or individual kind of project or experience. So I was still thinking, I mean, even as I like was really intrigued by the seniors, my French is like not great. Like I can read it well now because of the work of the book, but I had like stopped taking French in undergrad and so I wasn't really enthusiastic about reading in French. So I was still trying to think about like an Anglophone project, and I was still thinking about like 19th century African American literature. And a really good friend of mine, Sarah Johnson, her first book is on it's called Fear of French Negroes. And so she looks at the influence of the Haitian Revolution across the 18th and 19th century Caribbean. But I was talking to her and about actually Pauline Hopkins, because I was still like, I'm going to look at representations of the figure of the Latin 19th century. So I was like, okay, the seniors took me back, but I still want to do an Anglophone project. And I was talking to her and she was like, well, what about like that visual image of Sappho? And then we started talking, she's like, and then there's this image of Marie Laveau, like this painting of Marie Laveau. I should back up a little bit, because even though I was really still trying to do an Anglophone project, my questions were really about kind of the figure of the mulatta as like a fantastic figure, like as something that's figure that is marvelous and fantastic and kind of supernatural, and how 19th century authors look at that. And so that's how kind of Marie Laveau and came into the picture, and also noticing that in 19th century African-American literature, the figure of the mulatta almost inevitably either came through or went to New Orleans, right? So New Orleans is this really important imaginative site for thinking through the figure of the mulatta in the U.S. So that's how New Orleans became part of the kind of picture. And of course, you know, when I learned about the seigneurs, the most obvious kind of parallel for me were the quadroons of New Orleans and the lore around the quadroons of New Orleans, really echoing the stories and histories of the seigneurs of Saint Louis and Gorée. And then Erzuli came into play, and so this is important, right? Like I don't actually really look at colonial Saint-Domingue or Haiti as sites, like, or places in the ways that I do New Orleans and Senegal, but I bring Erzuli in because I was really struggling with the limits of the archive and how to kind of imagine free women of color from within diaspora, because it's not as if like people haven't written about the mulatta or free women of color or the seniors or quadroons. And a lot of this work is really useful. And obviously I couldn't do my work without it. But what I was kind of struck with was the ways in which people talked about the figure of the mulatta within white imaginations, right? White colonial imaginations, and as ways for colonizers and slaveholders to really kind of buttress their ideas of white masculinity. Mm-hmm. And so I was really interested. I was like, but how do Black people, basically I was like, how do Black people imagine or understand free women of color, like from within a framework of diaspora? And so that's where Erzuli came, because I was like, this is an archive that is produced by Black diasporic people and imaginations, right? In the ways that, travel narratives are not. And so that's how I came to kind of those three bases and then the three kind of key subjects in my text, the seniors, quadroons, and then Erzuli.
Yeah. And then, I mean, on the subject of colonial New Orleans, this is kind of a selfish question because I just visited New Orleans last month.
Yeah.
But I was curious, why was New Orleans such a unique place for free women of color? Or is that a leading question? Perhaps it wasn't. But what made it unique? And it seems like so many of these compelling narratives tend to merge there in your text. So why was this?
I mean, you know, New Orleans is a port city. It's, you know, the specific kind of history of New Orleans, right? The colonial history of New Orleans. And I think that especially within the U.S. landscape, right? So it's like the French settle it, then the Spanish, like it's, you know, it kind of trades hands back and forth between the French and the Spanish. And each, you know, colonial government leaves like its imprint, including ideas about race, right? Which are really, or I should say ideas about racial categorization, right? Racial categorization and whereas like the rest of the U.S. has like a bipartite racial categorization in terms of you're either black or you're white. In terms of kind of organizing who is enslaved and who is free. And while you have free people of color in the U.S. under slavery, right, it's not this like hard racial category, yeah, the ways in which free people of color are for like the French and the Spanish. And so I think that's, there's something about ports, and that's, you know, the one thing in this, the book that I kind of had to drop really reluctantly. And there's actually like, I'm trying to think about like how to work it out and flesh it out, is really thinking about the geography of these places. And here I'm, you know, totally indebted to Catherine McKittrick's work and thinking about Black geographies, but thinking about like, you know, New Orleans as like this port, this major port city, so that you have this constant influx of you know, it's not just like the French and the Spanish and the U.S., but then you also have the, you know, the refugees from the, you know, from the Saint Domingue, the Haitian Revolution. You have, as my book starts out with, you have slave ships coming from the west coast of Africa, including Senegal, and carrying captives, but also sometimes carrying, you know, free women of color as passengers from Senegal. So I think that there's just, there's something about the geography of New Orleans and also the ways in which, you know, Gwendolyn Midler Hall writes about Africans in colonial Louisiana, and she argues that, right, it's like the most kind of African space of the U.S. as well, because of the dynamics of how the slave trade happens there and how slavery happens, and, you know, which groups come to New Orleans. And so, yeah, it's such a central space for thinking about Blackness, for thinking about, you know, race and slavery and memory.
And then I guess building on this, as you discuss kind of the difficulties inherent to defining these racial categories, I feel like your book also works with the term freedom in different ways. There are like multiple meanings to this term. So how did you use the term freedom, especially given that I found some of the women you write about seem to be free and unfree at the same time in some ways?
Yeah, and this is something that I really wanted to press on and I struggled with, right? Because I didn't want to understate the privilege that free and freed women of color held in slave societies in terms of, you know, freer, you know, freedom of movement, freedom, you know, like more, you know, a greater likelihood of like having bodily autonomy, for example. And so I didn't want to overstate that, but I also did not want to lose sight, and I didn't want my reader to lose sight that these women existed in a spectrum between slavery and freedom, and that their freedom was always tenuous and contingent. And in fact, you know, the historical record shows us, across the board, where free people of color, right? I mean, are kidnapped or, you know, you know, otherwise like enslaved, right? And so I really wanted to kind of press on this notion of like, well, how to raise the question really about like, how might we understand the women themselves to have experienced this tenuous freedom? And so that was that was the tension I really wanted to hold on to, that they were at once privileged and had agency in the way that enslaved women did not, that there is an absolute distinction that's important to mark and note and analyze and think about. And the women that I examine, some of them were formerly enslaved, right? All of them had relatives that were enslaved. All of them had a precarious freedom. And I wanted to foreground that in terms of thinking about what are the possibilities and limits of freedom for Black subjects in these particular moments that I looked at.
Yeah. And I mean, I think the images you include in the book also speak to this. So the depictions of dress and clothing and headdress in particular as distinctive clothing for the particular group that you study. Could you say a little bit about why it's so significant, the clothing?
Yeah. And so this is where the different contexts, right, the different geographic and national contexts are really important. So on the one hand, you have the seigneurs whose headdress is completely distinctive to them. And across the historical record, the understanding is that the seigneurs, this is part of their cultural practice, right? This is a proactive cultural practice, and they are not required at any moment to wear the headdress. They don't have to wear the headdress to distinguish themselves from white women in the way that we see in Americas, right? With the sumptuary laws, right? So in New Orleans and in Saint-Domingue, but I want to talk about, you know, specifically in terms of thinking about the images I have, like in New Orleans, the Spanish in the late, in their colonial period, they passed what's called the Tignon Law. And basically, the problem is that you have free women of color, some of whom can pass as white, but whether they can pass or white or not, are visibly like free and enjoying their freedom, and some are building wealth and displaying their wealth through their dress. And so the Spanish imposed a Tignon Law to require free women of color to wear a head wrap to mark their racial status, and to link them to Blackness and then by proxy to slavery. And so I think it's a really interesting tension between how the head wrap operates in Senegal and how it operates in the Americas. And then, of course, what free women of color do in the Americas, right, is then they just kind of embrace the head wrap and the distinctiveness of a head wrap and then show up in bright, beautiful, luxurious styles and head wraps. And that also, and also proactively connect themselves to Blackness and Black womanhood in ways that are at once subversive and kind of affirming, right, of laws around race and freedom and visibility.
Yeah. So then I guess a close to final question, what role does ritual play among the women you examine and also in this study of diaspora? So women practicing perhaps voodoo ritual in New Orleans, for example, where does this theme fit in?
I think that I'm struggling with this because this is what I was struggling with in the book, is that on one hand, you know, I want to think about and explore and examine like how free women of color imagine themselves, how Black diasporic communities understood free women of color and interacted with them. And this is a really intimate question. And when I talk about intimacy, I'm talking about not just sexual intimacy and not always sexual intimacy, but, you know, just the intimacy of friendship and family relationships and sacred practices. And so the tension for me is wanting to examine that and think through its implications for both how we understand the women as historical subjects, but also contemporary possibilities of freedom, but also respect their right to privacy. And I know privacy is like a really complicated term, especially within kind of capitalist relationships, but to think about what's at stake in talking about these and how to talk about it in a way that I hope like remains respectful and even reverent of the women and ideas of ritual. And so, yeah, I really wanted to think about, and part of the way that I came into thinking about ritual is, again, coming back to the geography of these spaces, is that because they are slave ports, because they are ports, because they have populations that, and societies that both reinforce kind of rigid hierarchies around race and nation and class, but also press against those boundaries, I was thinking about these spaces as, or these places as liminal places, right? And if you think about like liminality in the anthropological sense, right, that's all about kind of ritual and this space of transformation, and oftentimes initiation. And so that's where I got to thinking about, okay, well, ritual as a site of transformation, but also like as a site of practice and rehearsal and becoming and coming back to really, again, trying to think about what are the ways that we can understand Black diasporic subjectivity as something that is positively defined and enacted, as opposed to always kind of in reaction to events outside of one's control, right? In terms of like the slave trade and colonization. And so that's part of where I was thinking about ritual and thinking through the ways in which throughout the archive, right, the dominant archive, especially with these travelers' narratives by white French men in particular, and how they persistently document the private, like intimate spaces of free women of color. And so I wanted to kind of read against that documentation and see how can I see how the free women of color encounter those invasions and endeavor to resist those invasions of privacy, or at least note that these are invasions of privacy. And also how do they like work to build and maintain kinship ties and communal ties in the face of these kind of constant assaults on their most intimate relationships. And so that's where ritual for me, like, so that's where, so thinking about hairdressing. And again, I'm building on and I'm drawing on the, you know, work from like so many scholars and historians of, and his name is, his name is escaping me, but this work on dress in Jamaica, and I can't believe his name is escaping me right now. But this book in particular was really helpful for me in terms of thinking about the head wrap, right, and the different ways that that enslaved and free women of color use the head wrap and dress to mark resistance, right? Stephanie Camp's work is really important there too. And so I think that that's like, so yeah, I guess for me, it comes down to that there's something really sacred about ritual. And I wanted to talk about it in a way that respected and held that sacredness close.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think your work does that. It's like, the concept of ritual is so compelling throughout the whole work. That's why I asked about it. And then I guess, so I mean, I think we should maybe wrap up our conversation, and I'd like to do so by asking the traditional final question at New Books Network. So what are you working on now? And does it relate to some of these unanswered questions from your first book?
Yes. And so, and if I could just quickly say, it's Steve O. Buckridge.
Okay, great.
I just wanted, that's the language address. But so what I'm working on now absolutely comes out of this first book. In terms of, because one of the things that kind of appeared late in my work on this book was really thinking about mothering practices of the seniors especially. And so while I do talk about it to some extent in my book, this question of like, what does it mean to mother in diaspora is the question that I want to keep taking up, especially in a contemporary moment, like in relationship to basically what Black people are facing mm-hmm. now, right? Mm-hmm. In terms of kind of the greater visibility of assaults on Black lives and particularly on Black children, and thinking about the role of the police. And so this project that I'm working on now is really looking at what I'm doing is I'm looking both at 19th century, and it's coming back to the U.S. It's coming back to my, like, you know, Anglophone comfort zone, at least for now. We'll see where it takes me. But so I'm looking at 19th century, 19th through contemporary African-American literature, but specifically looking at representations of enslaved motherhood in order to think through enslaved motherhood as really what I've called in other places, like ontological labor. It's like thinking about, like, okay, what does it mean when there's no kind of interest in this by the state or society to basically keep your child, you know, have your child like enjoy freedom, mm-hmm. right? And a life free of assault and threats to their life. And so, this project came to me again, thinking about in terms of mothering, practices in enslaved motherhood, but also thinking about this contemporary moment is like, how do Black mothers talk to their children about the police, who are, you know, the police as like a direct kind of descendant of the slave patrols. And so that's what I'm working on now, is like thinking through representations of enslaved Black motherhood, especially in terms of kind of like, how do Black mothers imagine and enact freedom for their children? How do they possibly kind of delve into or draw on ideas about motherhood and possibility outside, like from African diasporic religious traditions, and kind of like looking at those moments in 19th century texts as well, and really thinking through like Black motherhood as kind of a persistent engagement, if not state of fugitivity. Mm. So that's where I'm
working. Lisa, that sounds like a really important project and also a great project. So I want to thank you for being on the show today. I really enjoyed it. So thank you again.
Thank you so much. I really, really appreciated this opportunity. And yeah, no, I just thank you. The pleasure has been all mine. So
great. Looking forward to speaking to you again soon.
Okay. Thanks, Tyler.